I wanted to take an opportunity to remind everybody that while we are in a sanctuary, we're not going to exactly hear godly words during this podcast. It is not rated G. So please be prepared and forewarned. And now I'd like to welcome from the number one Jewish podcast in the world, Mark Oppenheimer, Stephanie Butnick, and Leo Leibowitz of Unorthodox.
Hello, Washington, D.C. We are elated to be the guest of Washington Hebrew Congregation. We are at a show co-sponsored by the Association of Reformed Jewish Educators, or as they call themselves,
ARJE.
We're trying to start a movement to call, get them to call themselves ARJE or ARJE. We'll see if that works. We're glad to be here tonight with many hundreds of you in what seems to be the Astrodome of Judaism. This is
like the high holiday space.
I don't know that I've ever been in a room this large when there wasn't professional sports being played. This is amazing. Our Jew of the Week this week is food historian and writer Michael Twitty. And our Gentile of the Week is newly elected Congresswoman Katie Porter. And Katie, I don't think I've seen since her wedding, which was a number of years ago, and before that, college. I mean, we were close friends in college, and then we have not seen each other much since. So it's exciting to be, like, you get a podcast, you get to see your old friend Katie.
I'm about to go to we'll get to everything else in the show, but I'm about to go to my 10-year college reunion, and I'm excited to think about the people who are going to end up being, in elected officials one day.
Yeah.
And I think it's, like, the people you least expect, maybe?
Katie is actually one of the people I least expect, and I will say that to her face in just a few minutes. But listen, before we get to the guests, what is Stephanie? What is up? What's up in Butnickiana?
That's not a place. But what's up with me is that it was the 20th anniversary of The Sopranos premiering, and I don't know about you guys, but I actually had never watched The Sopranos because I was a little young and then never really got into it. But I spent a lot of time this past week watching The Sopranos. Did anyone else do that? You read all the articles about it? Yeah, you did. That interview with David Chase. Anyway, one of my first observations was, like, four episodes in, there's a very serious subplot about these Jewish people and the husband is refusing...
They're called Jews, actually.
I was going to say this Jewish family. Basically, the husband's refusing his wife a get, and then, like, Tony Soprano has to go in and basically, like, do what you do to get guys to give a get, which is like the Jewish writ of divorce. And I was thinking, I'm like, no one told me to watch this show. Like, I always thought it was about, like, Italian Americans who are in the mafia. And it's actually about Jews.
It is odd that you made it this far in the Jewish worldwide media conspiracy and no one told you about the episode where they have to enlist the mob to get a get.
That's true, but you also haven't read Anne Frank, so.
That's true.
You know, we can all surprise you. But the thing I was thinking about is, like, because obviously Italian Americans were very upset at the beginning of this series that basically, you know, purported to show Italian Americans in a pretty bad light, right? Who are associations with mafia, things like that. Obviously a nuanced portrait. And it kind of made me think about that it was so long ago, but I'm sure it was, you know, a very, very, a big thing that the community talked about a lot. And it kind of reminded me how we were, like, all so upset about Mrs. Maisel. And I know it's, like, not portraying mobsters, but people are like, that butcher
right.
served pork.
Exactly. Our complaint was like, that is not kosher meat in the butcher scene. Their complaint is like, they kill people.
And they're like, that Tisha B'Av fast scene lasted 72 hours. That is not how long Tisha B'Av is. And it's like, you know, I think it puts things
they
in perspective.
They were not using that melody at a Reform temple in 1960. Adon Olam had not been done to that tune yet, right?
Yeah. Anyway, so it gave me some perspective, which I liked.
It's nice when ethnic groups get a TV show to kvetch about.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think really brings us all together.
Brings us all together. Leo, what's happening with you?
I never really connected with The Sopranos, you know? It's like, I guess how, like, when doctors probably don't like to go home and watch, like, doctor shows on TV. Like, if your dad's a bank robber, why would you watch The Sopranos? You're like, what is the show about? It's family and crime. It's like, nah, I'm watching Everybody Loves Raymond. I'm happy.
So nothing's going on with you except you're not identifying with The Sopranos.
Well, we have a host of things as ever. My older daughter Lily is about to have her sitter ceremony, which sounds
Who knows what that is? Hands.
Do these guys know what a sitter ceremony is?
Arche knows from sitter ceremonies.
They have a panel really on sitter ceremonies
good,
tomorrow morning.
They had one earlier today.
She was putting, like, a makeshift karaoke show with her brother on Sunday, and she's like, I'd like to sing two songs. The first is Party in the USA by Miley Cyrus. The second is Adonai Tzvatai Tiftach U'Pia Gitzi Hilotecha. And I'm like, and that is why I'm paying all my money to Jewish schools. I'm totally fine with that.
If they also gave her, like, say what that is so people know.
It's a ceremony by which you accept the Torah. If they also gave you, you know, a flag and a gun, I would consider her education complete.
Complete. No. Ellie is actually...
It's weird you don't watch The Sopranos.
You really should. Ellie,
like Corp in Israel, again. But too close.
My daughter Ellie, who's 10, is at the one of my five children's at Jewish day school, and she, in fact, has a yod ceremony coming up where they get their yods and they have to choose like a couple lines of Bereishit, and they'll, you know.
But speaking of daughters and major
events. Speaking of
moments.
Daughters and major events, the bat mitzvah is nigh. The op mitzvah. Rebecca's bat mitzvah is coming up, and it's been very moving. I mean, she's extraordinary. She's like been ready for 6 months now, and if she's over ready, and she, but you know, one of I think our family's goals was, and I think this is something that you think about in our audience, I'm sure, was how to keep it about Judaism, right? You know, the great joke, like, what's the theme of your daughter's bat mitzvah? Judaism.
I think we should kind of find a new way of doing bar and bat mitzvahs.
Please.
We should combine like all, no, I'm serious about this. We should combine like all of the things Jews love. It should be basically preceded by a standardized test. You take a test about Judaism, and then your score determines what kind of party you get to have. So if you get 100, you get like sushi stations, dancers, like whatever you want to have.
Party motivators, if, Coke and Pepsi.
If you got like, you know, 50, 45, you get a kiddush in the rec room of the shul. You know, you got 10 or 15, you get a, you know, kind of like a temporary tattoo of Tikkun Olam.
So
or
what's
something
on this test? Because I'd imagine it like a sorting hat.
Okay. Or we do Gryffindor and Slytherin.
Yeah.
But I know, riding on the train, you know, to hear, you were working on a very special document, right? You were working on the
I was doing the program. I was doing the program. And because Rebecca did see, and I have to say, the bat mitzvah we were at last weekend was so wonderful. This girl was so good, so amazing, leaned Torah so beautifully, gave such a good Devar Torah. And there was a wonderful, you know, program, as these things have, that really explained a lot of things to people who might not know stuff. And Rebecca said to me, because I said to her afterwards, is there anything you learned from that you want at your bat mitzvah? And she said, I really liked the program because it really explains stuff to people, even, you know, of course, perhaps especially Jews who don't know what's going on because they're away. And she said, Dad, would you make, I don't have any time, you know, would you make a program? So I was on the Amtrak today. And it is interesting thinking, what are the elements of this event that you want to explain? Like, if you're taking an 8.5 by 11 page and folding it in half and making a 4-page program and you only have so
and you
want
to do
words.
Like a few clip arts, so like there's not that much space.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, what is the key? Like, do you tell them what Musaf is?
You can tell them whatever you want, and they will assume it's true. I mean, that's it's amazing power. You could be like, our angry desert god demands we wear the sweatpants at sundown. Like, whatever.
I think I saw this on Broadway.
It's kind of true. I mean, it is a kind of awesome sense of power of like, if I tell them this is Judaism, right? I am their rabbi for this. So this is the special Washington, D.C. edition of News of the Jews. Apparently, they moved a synagogue in Washington not long ago. Apparently, it was a 143-year-old, 273-ton brick synagogue that was originally Addis, Israel. They rolled it down G Street.
One block.
One whole block. it was its third move since it was first constructed in 1876. Ulysses S. Grant presided over its dedication. And the original congregation in 1908 decamped to become Sixth and I Synagogue. And this one has done a lot of different stuff. It was a black church. It was a Greek Orthodox church. It was a barbershop. It was a barbecue restaurant. It was a treif restaurant for a while. And then a coffee
that's
shop.
That's why they had to actually move it.
That's how you kosher a barbecue joint. You just move it down.
Shake it out.
Does anyone imagine?
What are they going to do with it now? Does anyone know? Museum. Oh, I'm not going.
I would like for it to be like a rolling museum. And it would just be like kind of like a food truck.
I can really imagine the discussion. Rabbi, you know how nobody comes to synagogue anymore? What if synagogue came here. Although, you know, I bet you that having expelled the Jews, Ulysses S. Grant would be very pleased to know that you can now expel entire synagogues.
Entire synagogues.
It just does his work for him.
Speaking of Jews, Senator Ted Cruz, apparently.
Yeah, since we're in D.C., we're trying to keep it relevant. Ted Cruz has a beard now. I don't know if you've been on Twitter lately, but people
Wait,
are...
Beto has a beard, right? Beto O'Rourke grew a beard. Al Gore had a beard for a while. Now Ted Cruz has it.
That's the trifecta. That's a style story.
Yeah, they all do it.
He tweeted that his friend in Israel, who's studying at a yeshiva, said that a rabbi said, it gives Cruz a Talmudic and rabbinic look and presence that will put the fear of the Lord into Israel's enemies and promote Middle East peace. So basically, Ted Cruz's beard is going to solve the whole thing.
Like what Jared Kushner can't do,
Ted Cruz's beard can
do. Ted Cruz's facial hair can do.
Actually, it's kind of good. Like, it takes someone supremely unlikable to actually bring two peoples together. Like, the one thing we can all agree on is Ted Cruz.
What is the deal with that code? It's like, is Ted Cruz sitting at home thinking, like, how can I get people to fear me more? Maybe a beard. You know, like...
He's like, how do I get the rabbi vote?
That's right.
The Israeli rabbi vote.
Right. We are soon going to bring out our Jew of the Week, but before we do...
We have an exciting announcement.
Exciting announcement.
Tablet Magazine, which is where we work, which is the magazine that produces this podcast, we have a book coming out. It's called The 100 Most Jewish Foods, a Highly Debatable List, and it comes out next month just in time for Passover. And we're all part of it. Our guest, Michael Twitty, wrote an amazing entry for it, and there's really great contributors, Michael Solomonov, Gail Simmons, Josh Molina, writing about everything from gefilte fish to Persian rice and Yemenite chicken, babka, matzo balls, everything. And things you hate, too. The book comes out March 19th, but we want you guys to pre-order yours so you'll have yours March 19th. And we are sort of incentivizing that by doing a giveaway. So if you pre-order the book and then you forward that receipt, it doesn't have to be like the actual credit. We don't need your credit card number. Right. To this email, which is...
It's 100foods@tabletmag.com.
You will be entered to win one of 5 gift certificates to Russ and Daughters. And they ship all over the country. So, like, that is some serious stuff. It's $150.
$150.
And we're going to be putting this out there just to, you know... I'm getting hungry kind of thinking about it.
You could be in a locks coma for, like, a week.
Yeah, you could just get locks.
Kind of money.
So, you can get that on Amazon everywhere... Your local bookstore. Yes.
Kramer Books.
You can pre-order in-store as well. So we're really excited about that. Thank you, guys. Michael Twitty is a writer, scholar, and historian of food culture. His 2017 book, The Cooking Gene, won a James Beard Award, and he contributed one of the most interesting entries to our 100 Most Jewish Foods book. It's pachah, and I'll let him tell you all about it. Welcome, Michael.
Yeah.
Pachah.
Jewish soul food.
Will you tell us what it is?
Pachah is...
And how it's spelled. How about that?
You know it's good when you have to think for like 30 seconds before telling you what it is.
Pachah. P-apostrophe. Don't forget the apostrophe. T-C-H-A. Is an excuse to eat garlic. It's literally what happens... when you take a cow's foot and boil it to death, and then you put as much onion and garlic as possible. By the way, being a former Hebrew school teacher of 14 years, at Temple Beth Ami and Temple Shalom here in the DC area, never teach seventh grade boys the Yiddish word for garlic. Or onion, sorry. Sibilis.
So you might say
We learned today about sibilis in Hebrew school. You learned what? Okay. Shouldn't trust that black guy. Okay, keep going.
Do you like pachah?
I've had it once. But you know what? For me, there are these 3 or 4 like traditional shtetl foods that I just don't vibe with, one of which is not really a shtetl food. It's like an after shtetl food, and that's kind of Dr. Brown's celery. Like,
I am a trillion percent with you there. Who thought
same here? When did that become a thing?
Take it back.
Yeah.
What about like diet cherry?
So that's like Karen's potato salad? No.
Cherry.
Yeah.
No, it's got raisins in it? Nope.
Agreed.
So yeah, that and Kugel took me a long time too. I was like, why? I said Kugel. And, you know, I had to get used to it. And plus, I had to put more sugar in it. And I was just like, okay. Kugel is like Ashkenazi juice, macaroni, and cheese, but without the stuff in it. You know, cream cheese, yeah. Which to us is not cheese, you know. I was like, eh. So it's like, okay. So I had to rationalize these foods in my brain. But just like gefilte fish for me is an excuse to eat horseradish.
Yeah.
No other purpose. You eat it by itself, they say you've been shaking, take it to the hospital. Same thing, pacha. It's an excuse to eat garlic and onions. Sibilis.
So we're definitely going to get back to the food, but before we do, what kind of Hebrew school teacher were you?
A crazy one. I taught Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist, and Independent Havara, all in 1 week. Kippa, Sruga, no Kippa, Kippa, Black Hat, all of them.
That sounds like the premise of like the next Adam Sandler comedy.
Right.
To win $100 million, he has to teach every kind of Hebrew school.
But I live that life. And I was, for a lot of my students, for about 80% of my students, I was the only teacher of color they ever had. I was the only Black male teacher almost all of my students ever had, in or out of Hebrew school. And the only figure of authority of color they ever saw in a synagogue. So I take great pride in that. Now all my kids are almost, I think my last group is grown. You know, it's not every day you get to make Black and Jewish history by, you know that your kids had an experience. And it was always my favorite thing. By the fifth or sixth year, the kids were like, you know, when they had smartphones finally, they could take a picture with you. And so I'm like, exoticism. And they were like, no. Some kid at school said, there are no Black Jews. My teacher's a Black and he's Jewish. So we come in all colors, and I was very proud of that because it was already seeing that us and supposed to them and you is us, our.
That's so amazing. But that, I imagine, puts like an immense amount of pressure on you, right? Because you know, first time you walk into that class, you're like, I need to educate these kids about a whole lot more than just what the curriculum
is. That's something that I think that a lot of the other teachers who I taught with, it took them years to understand that. That when I walked into a classroom, and there was a Trayvon Martin situation, or there was some political situation or some other nonsense going on, a flashpoint, I had to answer for that in a highly segregated area called the DMV. So my students often would test my boundaries, but also kind of try to figure out, what does being Black mean to you? And the best lesson of all was this lesson I did on, what does a Jew look like? And I asked them, I said, why do I look like this? And one of the kids said, well, your ancestors were in Africa and they were in the sun too long and they had a tan. So, what is it? And there's one young lady, she's in college now. She had red hair and blue eyes. I said, do people think you're Jewish? She says, no, they think I'm Irish. And I said, I don't know what that means because both of my parents come from Russian Lithuanian Jews. I don't know what that means. And I said, see, it's not just me. And so I asked them, who's the most Jewish person, Jewish looking person in the room? And they were really, I mean, it was kind of evil, right? And so looking around the room, so I had to explain to them, no, I'm African American, I'm of mixed heritage, not everybody looks like me, blah, 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 blah. We're all different. We all, no matter what our face looks like, our phenotype is, you know, what we are inside is what keeps the same, what is maintained, our spiritual identity. So for me, having those conversations, I hope, leads to people who walk into a jury or a voting booth or witness an incident involving law enforcement, and they have a different perspective than someone who did not have an encounter with a teacher who could guide them a little bit and say, wait a minute, this is how the other half lives.
And so that's education. Right.
But you know what? From another perspective, I think a lot of people who convert to Judaism, no matter what the background, I have Jewish ancestry, but it's not halakhic, right? I think for me, the biggest thing was people who tried to put imposter syndrome on me. Oh, I lost that real quick. That kind of like, am I not? Because I taught 1,000 Jewish kids. I saved 1,000 Jewish souls from going somewhere else. And I talked to my Reform kids the same way I talked to my Orthodox kids. And I said, it doesn't matter if your father's Jewish, your mother's Jewish, you this, mm-mm. We're all one mishpacha. It doesn't matter. I taught my girls how to put on tefillin. I taught my boys, putting on a kippah doesn't make you any less or more Jewish. I taught them that if anybody ever questions your Jewish identity, you tell them to take it up with Hitler. Get in their face and tell them that you would have been in the same boat. So we're one people. How our customs, what food we put on our tables, whether or not we wear a certain religious garb means nothing if the basis of being Jewish isn't how we believe and act towards each other and our fellow human being. That's what a Jew is.
Michael, I can't tell you how much I admire your conviction, but I'll be lying if I said that the thing that I admire most about you is that you won the one award that I considered worth winning in this world. Like, if you ask me, I don't care about Oscars, Emmys, Grammys. You won a beard award, man.
Look, I won I won two. And let me tell you something about that award. I'm going to tell you why I'm bragging about that, too. The two lichot, right? when we pitched this book to some of the biggest publishers in the food world, and not just food world, but you know, the big companies in New York, I remember this awful day. My mom had passed away a couple months before. I was on my first big phone call. I was on the side of the road in North Carolina, which I often am. And they were like, the cooking gene is all about me tracing my African-American roots through food. And there's a huge part of it that involves being Jewish, because I told them, I said, I'm black, I'm Jewish, I'm gay, oh my. And, you know, Bears United. And I want to make sure that you understand that I'm like a challah, I'm like a braided challah. All those pieces have to work together. And you can't separate one out from the other. And they got it, they were a fit. And the editor told me, I'm sorry, but unless you can extract the Judaism from this book, we can't work with you. And I said, what's your problem? And of course, there's two Jews sitting in the room in New York, right, telling me this, right? And they're telling me this because
nobody's less Jewish than the Jewish editors of New York City.
And it's like, well, the thing I got told was, America's not ready for you. And I told them immediately, America's the only country where I'm possible. So unless, so I had my Sandy Koufax moment. They literally told my agent I couldn't be seen in public wearing a kippah. Ugh, right? So I was so glad.
In fairness, they tell the same thing to me. So.
Baby, I was so glad when I got up on that stage the first time and they said, you won for best food writing. And I got the smile on their face. I saw them sitting in the audience. I was like, find it with your eyes. And then the second time, it was like book of the year. It was like, first black American to win this award. Made history in one night. Yeah. And I said the Shehakianu from the stage.
And we should tell our listeners, the James Beard Award is like the biggest thing in the food world for restaurants, for writers, for things like that.
To call
that.
It the Oscar of food writing would insult food writing.
So the cooking gene is out, and actually people here can buy it.
And by can we mean should or must?
But you will buy it on your way out. You have to pass it, and how are you not going to buy it at this point? But so there's another book coming out, right?
Kosher Soul.
So Kosher Soul, what journey is that?
Kosher Soul is about learning and cooking. My favorite Yiddish word is fresh from kite, which means you're Jewish through your stomach. You're religious through your stomach.
Second only to syphilis.
After you get your syphilis. You have to, in other words, you have to, you're religiously dedicated to the cycle of Jewish food. And for me, I started out as a food anthropologist, culinary historian, and that drew me into Judaism. And so learning and teaching go hand in hand. Like genealogy was a leitmotif with this book. That search, the very difficult search for African and African American roots. But this one is all about how do you learn to be Jewish through food? And how do you teach about Judaism through food? How do you find your niche and identity in Judaism when you're not born into a Jewish community? But you have these very deep, weird, spiritual, you know, links that are there.
So, I mean, just to play devil's advocate, you know, this is a question we deal with on the podcast a lot, right? Some of our listeners will hear that and say, but They'll say, but we don't want Judaism reduced to food. In other words, we have a lot of Jews out there right now who are saying, my Jewishness is like Lender's bagels. Yes. And not just bagels, like bad frozen prepackaged bagels. Like
right.
New Haven's gift to the world, Lender's bagels, right?
And of course, I don't, you know, the same way I don't want black identity reduced to greens and chicken.
Right.
Right? But I do understand this. I understand that when I learned about tahinis, which are, you know, the prayers of women, Yiddish-speaking women, over the challah and the kugel, I said, this is like the most amazing stuff. And then food is also a way into other parts of identity. For example, there's a rabbi during the Middle Ages who says, who wrote a poem called, Why Hast Thou Not Made Me a Woman? And half the poem is about food. But it's a poem about a male rabbi who wishes God had made him a girl.
So that he could cook?
So that he could cook and be with his husband and observe the feminine mitzvot. So we think of the T in LGBT as being recent. This goes back centuries. But to know that in his head was this remarkable sadness. That every time he looked at those sacred foods, he was reminded that something was off with him, that he wished he could, you know, I identify, because I'm a queer person, right? So I can identify with that and go, oh my God. And so when you make the food that people have made for generations, each and every single time when you're conscious of it, you get this little bit of a spark of immortality and also this bit of, you know, sadness because, you know, inevitably it will change.
So if you could pick one food, one Jewish food that really kind of, you know, sparked your soul, that you really felt kind of like moved by.
Grebenes.
Really? Awesome.
Oh my God, Grebenes. The food you can only eat once in a decade. I mean that literally. I mean, it's just some serious, just, we're not going to let any scrap go. We're going to turn trash into gold. We're going to make goose fat and goose skin into the most delicious thing ever.
Will you describe what Grebenes is or
Grebenes is poultry skin fried in schmaltz. Mit Sibilis, mit Pfeffer, mit Salis, Agishmat. The best. I mean, just
do you make Grebenes?
Once in a while,
the only place I've ever seen is the Second Avenue Deli gives you the little dish.
You know
of it
the
when
best thing
down,
I ever
right?
heard about Grebenes? So, of course, I attract other Jews with interesting backgrounds, and I was having Seder with this Orthodox family who was Mexican American, but their people came from Eastern Europe to Mexico 3 generations ago, and so she was describing. I think she had made mole with the Pesach turkey, which is amazing. And then there was like, she described taquitos filled with Grebenes. And I said, wow.
Now wait, there's your food truck. Wow. The Grebenes taco food truck.
That is. Let's quit right now.
Yeah.
There just we go on the road.
Who's there in?
Pick that synagogue and like start selling Grebenes out of it.
I mean, that just sounds, yeah.
According to your Instagram, you've been traveling a lot.
Yeah.
You've been all over. You've been Italy, Ghana, Italy.
I got engaged in Italy.
Congratulations.
Thank you. For that about. In Venice, I did it right. In Venice on the Grand Canal. Okay.
Yeah. Not messing around.
Yeah, where would the wedding be? I mean, what do you do for encore now?
You know what the weird part was? We ran into Aziz Ansari in Rome for some reason.
That guy loves Italy.
And I was like, hey, Aziz Ansari, do you want to come to a Jewish, semi-Methodist, gay, interracial wedding? It's like, sure. Sounds great. But I was like joking with you all backstage about dating. You know, when I had Shagat's appeal, Jewish boys loved me to death. The minute the kippah went on, So girls, I understand. Like, nope. It was not trying to have it.
It's the resistance to making mom too happy.
See, I was right. I was supposed to scare mom,
that's
not
right.
make her happy.
That's right.
Exactly.
The erotics is in scaring mom, yeah, not in pleasing her. That's
oh,
right.
The minute oh, they were going to say, oh, he's Jewish. Bring him home. He's black too. Oh my God, this is going to be so
that
great.
That also raises the question. I mean, that also raises the question. I know there's been a big, I'm not on social media, but I have social media minions who inform me what's on social media. They send me handwritten parchment letters in the mail that say, what's been on Twitter lately is this. And my understanding is there have been a lot. I mean, one of the big debates of the past, I don't know, you know, 6 months, year has been the question of, you know, are Jews white? And that whole question, and do they have, you know, do they have minority privilege? Do they have, you know, what's the intersectionality valence of being Jewish, et cetera? I mean, do you surely get called on to talk about that question?
Yeah, and I try to avoid it as much as possible. I'll tell you why. I want to live by example. I'm going to write about some of these things in Coach's Old, but not a lot, because really not my thesis. But I have to. But I have to talk about it, right? Because otherwise, I don't get called for interviews. NPR loves a brother.
We could call you for interviews.
So, but I will say this much: a couple things. Number one, having become more engaged with other Jews of color in the past 5 years, and having spent a long period of the time being the only raisin in the kugel in the room, you got that right. Mm-hmm. Fan yourself. Now, I have to say that one of the modern Judaism has struggled with the role of women. And this is still a growing and going conversation, right? It hasn't stopped, and that's good. Because, like any other tradition, Judaism is nothing. The Jewish people don't live without its mothers, its women, its wives, its daughters. It's feminine presence. We've started to deal with LGBT issues. Why are we so afraid to talk about race? Race is an illusion. I realize that. It's not real. Race is something that was put on people to make them into a commodity. I get that. Race is a total illusion. It's not scientific. We are all one human race, indivisible. But, you know, I had a number of times when as a teacher, I had to school my kids on, that's not cool, and don't you understand that? And they didn't get it, and I had to do it over and over again until they finally got it. To talk about, and like I said earlier, a lot of my fellow teachers didn't realize I had that extra burden. I mean, for God's sakes, I came to school riding the Metro bus past McMansions. I was the only teacher who rode a bus from my poor neighborhood to the shul. They didn't understand. How come you don't have a car? How come you didn't do this? What's wrong with you that you didn't attain? I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Let's break this down. And so for me, you know, we teach our kids that it is we, not when those Ethiopian Jews, when we were in Ethiopia. You know you've succeeded when your kids go, when we were in China, taking ownership of that community and saying they're part of us. The second part is everybody is intersectional and multicultural. Everybody in this damn room is intersectional and multicultural. Y'all ain't been the same since 1500. Nope, that's what being an American is. And if you are not intersectional and multicultural, you're not trying very hard to be an American or to be a modern person. Let's get that straight. So we have to deal with this because this is our community against white supremacy. And that goes both ways. So we are unified in this. And I mean, I know we have different perspectives, and I know this can get people, you know, very enraged, but at the same point in time, imagine what it's like being a Jew of color. You're asked to represent both your peoples. You're asked to hold your head up. And sometimes people on both sides drive you absolutely crazy, and they make you feel like you don't belong anywhere. Who stands up for us? So that, if nothing else, let's try to solve that problem.
I'm curious though, Stephanie.
Absolutely.
You're a tough person to interview because everyone claps after everything you say.
That's right. Stephanie just mentioned, you know, the travel all around the world. I'm curious how, I understand how all these complexities are. I think I could begin to wrap my head around how all these complexities might play out here, which is very difficult on its own term, right? But what happens when you get to say Italy and be like, oh, hey, I'm a...
Well, then he's got Aziz Ansari as a fellow man
right.
of color. So
I'm a Jew of color who's gay. Is like, does any of this play very differently?
Going to West Africa, which I'm going back to in March, has really, like, especially Senegal, because Senegal was like, made me feel cool about my identity, because I'm wearing Jiniame, which is a Ghanaian proverb, means God is everywhere, next to my gay AF button with my kippa on, right? It's all of them are there, right? But in Senegal, you know, you would see a Muslim family, a Muslim husband, Christian wife, Islamic stuff, Christian stuff, but also juju in every single room. So this kind of, it made me feel comfortable with the fact that Black spirituality, for lack of a better term, is very different. Because it's almost like carrying around a keychain with a lot of keys on it. One of them's gonna work. Mm-hmm. That's how my grandmother lived, and that's how they live in the continent. And so I feel much more comfortable about the fact that sometimes, you know, my kids would joke with me and say, Mr. Twitty, you're going to become the first black Jewish preacher. And I'm cool with that, because that means that I am authentic to the culture I come from, where you take everything and make it work.
Two final questions. Yep. First of all, when can we expect the next book? How far along is Kosher Soul?
Well, as soon as the beard thing happened, like, it went from being la-da-da-da-da to when can you push out a new book?
Right.
So hopefully, Bezrat Hashem, God, when the creek don't rise. See that blend right there? And by the way, I'm glad that you didn't mention Lindsey Graham's beard. Oh, Lindsey. He's so cute, isn't he?
I'm glad you did.
You know, he got one. But it's Hanukkah of this year.
Hanukkah 2019.
Yep.
All right, we're going to hold you to that. Final question. You're going to hang and sign copies of this book after?
Absolutely.
Michael Twitty, thank you for being here for the week.
Thank you.
Hey there, listeners. I hope you are enjoying this episode. This is Mark Oppenheimer here with my co-host, Stephanie Butnick.
Hi.
Hey. So I personally think this show was one of the best live shows in the history of our show and maybe the history of all podcasts.
It was amazing. It was so good and so fun.
So fun. But before we get back into it, I just wanted to let everyone out there know that if you like what you hear, you are in luck because we have more live shows coming up in the next few weeks. Stephanie, our first stop is Los Angeles, Friday, February 1st. What are we doing in L.A.?
We are doing a special Kabbalat Shabbat live show at Adat Shalom on Westwood Boulevard. That's on the west side for all you L.A. folks who have asked. That's the first question everyone asks. Is it on the east side or the west side? And so we have some amazing guests. We have Lauren Miller Rogan, who is a writer, director, actor. Her latest movie is Like Father, which starred Kristen Bell and Kelsey Grammer and is on Netflix. And she also promotes Alzheimer's awareness and research with her Hilarity for Charity organization.
Our Gentile of the Week is TV writer for shows like Blackish, Jonathan Groff, who has also worked on Scrubs, How I Met Your Mother, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, where he was the head writer for more than 400 episodes. I was just so excited to learn that he was a Gentile and could actually be our Gentile of the Week, because as we've learned, you never know. You think you've got a Gentile and they always turn out Jewish anyway. But this guy, real Gentile.
We have to go to LA to find a good Gentile. And we also have Persian Jewish social entrepreneur Rachel Sumek, who is amazing. She's on those Forbes 30 under 30 list, and her Swipe Out Hunger organization helps fight hunger on campus. It lets students donate unused food point swipes to students in need. And she's just great. And I'm so excited to have her as well. So that's three great guests.
It's going to be so great. A spirited Kabbalat Shabbat and then a live show afterwards. To get tickets, go to bit.ly/UOLiveLA. That's bit.ly/UOLiveLA.
And so we will be doing a Kabbalat Shabbat service before the live show. You are welcome to join for that. Also, we have it on word from the rabbi that you will still be allowed in the show if you don't make it to the service. So whatever works for you.
Yep. And then we'll be heading up the coast the next day to Seattle. Don't tell anyone that we're skipping shul that morning, okay? February 2nd, Saturday evening, we will be at the Strom JCC for a live show with Dan Savage of the Savage Lovecast, one of our favorite podcasts. And Stephanie, who else is joining us?
We have Rabbi Will Berkovitz. He is from the Jewish Family Services and formerly of the Hillel organization. And so he's sort of a big macher with Jewish life in the Seattle area. So we're excited about that too.
That's going to be great. We already have a bunch of questions for Dan that have come in through email, through Facebook. Listen, if you want to get your question to Dan, it's not too late. You can send it to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Put Savage Love in the subject line. We will anonymize it for you. You can also call our listener line, 914-570-4869. We will put a weird filter over your voice so that nobody knows it's you asking. If people want to get tickets for that show, Stephanie, how can they do it?
bit.ly/UOLiveSeattle. And if you guys don't live there, but know someone who does, tell them to come. Tell them they cannot miss an Unorthodox live show because they are very fun.
Very fun. And now back to our live show from Washington Hebrew Congregation with the Association of Reformed Jewish Educators, or as we call them, RJ. Our Gentile of the Week is Representative Katie Porter of the California 45th. She's a member of the newly Democratic majoritarian House and part of the record-breaking 102 women elected to Congress in the 2018 midterm elections.
She had to win a grueling primary and then one of the longest counts of the year before she was certified as the winner. She was born in Iowa. She passed through New Haven, where I got to know her 25 years ago. We're thrilled.
And now she is here.
We're thrilled our Gentile of the Week is Katie Porter.
So what do we call you?
Congresswoman?
Congresswoman.
Congresswoman.
Does that still sound exciting to you?
Yeah, it still sounds exciting, and it took me a little bit to get used to it, but then I remembered when I was younger and sterner, on my first night before I went to teach, I was a law professor, and I remember my mother asking me, are you going to make your students call you professor? And I said, only if they want me to answer. And so I thought, like, what has happened to the fire in the belly? Like, I need to kind of up my game again.
Wait,
so,
pause on that for a second. So should we not call someone Representative so-and-so?
No, you can call representative.
Representative's okay. Congresswoman, yeah. Or representative.
Yes, got either it. One. And some people go with Congress member as opposed to Congresswoman. So that's something I've been to go with a non-gendered term. So
got it.
And so would it be Congresswoman Porter? Like if I...
Yes, so you would say,
yeah, I like that.
So I recently was reading up on this because I was having a ceremonial swearing in my district, and I was trying to figure out what my own invitation to my own event should say. And so you would address an envelope. It's like a judge. You would address the envelope, the Honorable, which I find funny, the Honorable Katie Porter, and then when you speak to me, it's like Judge so-and-so, so it's Congressmember Katie or Congressmember Katie Porter. But I will say there are two Katies in Congress. Fellow Californian, Katie Hill. And even though there's like a million Bobs and a million Mikes and a million Joes and a million Toms and they're all white dudes, nobody gets them mixed up. But on my big moment of glory on January 3rd, the day I was sworn in, Nancy Pelosi is up at the dais and she singles me out. And she says, I just want to say happy birthday to Congresswoman Katie Hill. And her children, and Katie Hill has no children. And the speaker got a little confused, but she got it squared away because she has secret whisperers who fix everything that she thinks. And so she never, like very rarely makes these mistakes. So I am one of two Katies. Which
you're
is
Katie P.
Yeah.
This is fairly stressful for me because I had a friend who was low down in the Obama administration who told me that, you know, when you work for the president, even if you're his bestie, like even if you're one of the people who came up with him in Chicago, when in the presence of other people, you don't say Barack, you say Mr. President. And I'm wondering, are we on...
You're at the congresswoman level.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought so. I was.
But I will tell you, I mean, Mark and I... do go way, way back. And I was thinking as I was on my way coming in, that there is a bit of sort of interesting history, not just to the fact that I know Mark, because he was just one more person at Yale. One more Jew, really, at Yale.
but I was the Jew at Yale, right.
That Mark, I don't know if you remember this, but Mark was the first person who took me to the kosher kitchen. And when we went to the kosher kitchen, so keep in mind before you judge me that I am the Gentile of the week. Gentle to the Gentile of the week as I tell you this story. So I grew up in Iowa. I was a little clueless about Jewish culture. And so Mark invites me to the kosher kitchen and they are serving hamburgers. And Mark is like, do you want a hamburger? And I was like, no, I want a cheeseburger. And Mark said, we don't have cheeseburgers. And I was like, are you out? I started to badger, like the staff at the kosher kitchen, right? And then I went to get my milk, and there is no milk. And I was just deeply, like, confused. And then, you know, this was before you had Google, like, right there to solve your problems. And so Mark kindly explained to me the concept for the first time of kosher food, which is a concept that has been explained to me repeatedly by the JCC where my son went to preschool, because when you're a mom and you're a single working mom and you're in a hurry, One day I was like, oh my God, this is great. I have like a nutritious kind of thing. I'm not just going to put some crackers in and some yogurt. I'm going to send my son to school with a big old piece of fried chicken and some mozzarella cheese sticks. And I threw this all together. And of course, it comes back and you open up the lunchbox. And to really drive home.
They have a little Jew-shaming note that they sent back?
They have a Gentile-shaming note that's like kind of melded onto the food that you've missent. And so you have to like scrape the note off the food and then dump the food out. So you were the first, but not the last person to explain this.
We will not shame you tonight, but I do want to ask, like, how do your kids feel about this? Do they think it was cool being up there with you? Do they like, are they embarrassed? Like, do they understand?
I'm just going to guess. Kids never think their parents are cool, right? Do your kids think you're cool?
No, so I will tell you, the most touching moment of the entire campaign, and I was a candidate for not quite 2 years, so it was a very, very long campaign, but the most touching moment was I allowed my oldest son, I chose my oldest son, who just turned 13 on Saturday, to introduce me on election night. And at the time I was taking the stage, we didn't think I had won. Wouldn't say we were sure I'd lost, but we didn't think I'd won necessarily. And so the crowd is tense. People are a little sad. They're uncertain. And my son gave my introduction. And I learned a couple of things from this. One is I learned, before you allow your child to introduce you, make sure that he's not a better public speaker than you. So my son had the crowd chanting, Luke, 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 Luke. I mean, he brought down the house. And then the second thing is at the very end, he said, it's my pleasure to introduce my mom, my hero, Katie Porter. And so the other lesson here is like, make sure that you like are not going to get teary at this big moment because, so it was really great. So they had fun on the campaign. I do think a lot of candidates, particularly candidates with young children, maybe more men than women, think that campaigning is a hardship. It's like something that your children endure. Right? And so it's really not. It was a family event for us. It was a family experience. So I took my kids to all kinds of campaign stuff. Sometimes that worked out great. Like election night, my son did a great job. Sometimes it was funny. So I took my children to hear our California governor, Gavin Newsom. And there was in a small room, and it was a public event, just free and open to the public, and my middle son kept raising his hand, and I kept, like, pulling it down. And Gavin himself has 4 kids, and so Gavin likes kids, and so, like, the second Paul, I was like, oh, no. And so Paul, he calls on Paul, and he says, yes, young man. And Paul says, you're a lot better at this than my mom. Can you help her? And I was like... And Gavin, who of course has been campaigning really, let's face it, all of Jerry Brown's 8-year governor term, Gavin very kindly said, well, she's had, I've had a little bit more practice than your mom. And your mom is pretty great. But I think my kids really had fun with the experience. I will say that, particularly the shutdown and kind of the chaos that it's creating for this country, and including for my own schedule, I have to call my kids tonight and tell them I'm not coming home necessarily. And next week, I'm not necessarily going to be with them because we're rearranging things, trying to get the government open. We're really trying everything we can to get the government open. But and I, after I won, I remember saying to my kids, well, the re-elect starts now. And we have to start working on 2020. And my son said, what? And I said, well, yeah, it's every 2 years. And my son said, oh, Mom, maybe just once. Like, he was floored by this idea of this perpetual campaign that is the House of Representatives, for better or worse. So
now that you're here, now that you're in Congress, how are you hoping to make a difference? And will you tell us a little bit about some of your great ideas?
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about kind of what we are trying to do and then kind of things that I personally want to work on. So the 2 bills that I'm very excited about that I think we will pass in the House very soon, I think as soon as we get the government open, we'll move these bills forward. One is a voting rights campaign reform anti-corruption bill. And That is the so-called HR1, right? So it's a little bit like when you play a sport, like there are cool numbers, and HR1 is the number. And so I'm really excited about that bill. I think if we don't make real progress on some of these issues, it's going to be hard to get people moving on other issues. So this, a lot of us campaigned on, and I think this election was about restoring our faith in our democracy and some of our institutions of government, some of which are being badly tarnished. And so I think that's really exciting. And then I'm also really excited about the HR 8, which is a gun violence prevention bill. And it would institute mandatory national background checks. And so close some of the gun show loopholes, some of those things. So
is there any chance the Democrats are going to cave on the border wall?
I am not going to cave on the border wall. I say this to you as somebody who is about 90 miles from the Mexico-United States border. I represent an area that historically was formed. Orange County was kind of populated by a lot of, frankly, white people fleeing Los Angeles. But it's become a more diverse place, and I think there's just multiple reasons why it's the wrong thing to do. And I think one of the things that we've said is, look, border security is important, but we're not going to discuss border security until he opens the government. And we've given him lots of opportunity, the president, lots of opportunities to do that. And so the goal is not, you know, the goal is to make investments in border security, to make investments in our immigration system. But the physical wall, for me, is off the table. It's a waste of taxpayer dollars. It sends the wrong signal. It's contrary to our history as a country, the best of our history. And I think it, so I very much hope that we stand strong.
So to stay for a minute on this partisan vibe, you unseated a two-time Republican incumbent in really one of the closest election, right, winning by, I think, something like 12,000 votes eventually, in a campaign that took a long time, in a count that took a long time. Be honest here, like at some point, did you really develop like a strong animosity for your opponent? You're like, I just can't stand her.
You know what's interesting? I really didn't. So I defeated a Republican named Mimi Walters. It was one of a few woman-on-woman races. I actually think that was a benefit in that people quit asking me what it was like to run as a woman. Like, I've never been a dude, so I don't know. Like, I can't give you that perspective, right? Like, and so I think there was less talk about what does it mean to be a woman and more on the issues. I think it was after I was elected and began to understand some of the tools that those of us in Congress have to help our constituents and some of the tools that those of us have to help people, that I began to become even more disappointed kind of in that representative, because it became clear to me that she had not used a lot of those tools. So in terms of caseworkers and in terms of engaging the public, so she never had a town hall, she never had a public meeting. I was in a room like this, 700 people during my primary. We were asked to raise our hands if we had ever seen Mimi Walters in person. I was the only one of the five candidates who had. I saw her at a Memorial Day event where she was giving the Pledge of Allegiance. And I rushed right up to her. And I was like, Representative Mimi Walters, it's Katie Porter. And she did not share my enthusiasm. And she literally like turned on her heel and kind of fled. So it was grueling. I mean, it was a hard race, but I don't think I ever developed a personal animosity. I just partly never met her. And so I was running more against an idea than I was against an actual person. And I think that was a reflection of her weakness as a representative.
So what will your day-to-day, you know, once the government hopefully soon gets up and running, what is your schedule look like? How much are you in California? How much are you here? And how does that play into your calculus, especially with your children?
Yeah, so this is something that we're talking a lot about right now, sort of what does it mean to do the work of representing the American people? And I think one of the things that we need to do is help the American people understand what we do when we're in our home districts. And so I think the perception is that we're in Washington, we're working, and we're in our home districts, we're at home, but we're actually, we have two offices at least, one in Washington and at least one or more in the district. And that time in district is really, really important. And so we're, there's kind of a balance going back and forth on how much time should we spend in our districts. And I think the shutdown is really driving this home. So should we stay here all week and wait and wait and hope that the Senate does something? Or should we go home and listen to the voices of those who are being hurt by this shutdown, right? And so which one is the better use of our time? Which one helps convey how important this is to us? And so I think right now we kind of have the traditional calendar. It's roughly 3 weeks in D.C., and I go home every all the time because I have three kids and nobody else wants to take care of them. So,
what's your airline and how are your miles?
Well, so that is really, it's funny you mentioned that because just today I said to my staffer, she said, well, you know, ma'am, what she calls me ma'am, it's really cute. And my son has picked this up and I find it so endearing in my teenage son.
Your staffer
calls
got
me,
your son to start ma'aming
yes,
you?
Yes, it's like the best. She should get a bonus.
Staffer to get my kids to start
Yeah. And so she said, ma'am, what are these, which of these flights would you like? And I just said like, Are we not communicating? It was kind of like when you're having this, like, do we need to break up conversation? And I was like, I don't fly United. And all you keep doing is giving me United flights. Like, is there a problem with American Airlines? Are they, like, worse? I mean, they all seem equally bad to me, right? I think about airlines and credit card companies and cable companies. It's like, just choose one because they're all bad. And so, like, you will be dissatisfied. And so right now I would tell you that I'm in coach. I'm in a middle seat.
A lot of people feel the same way about politicians, by the way.
Exactly, exactly. And so, yeah, no, it's. I'm just struggling along in coach with American.
With American.
Yeah, and I picked American because they serve Diet Dr. Pepper. Just.
So listen, you've never been a Gentile of the Week before.
Except at the Kosher,
except at the Kosher Kitchen. Kosher Kitchen.
And the JCC.
I was more like Gentile of the Year, I think.
But one of the privileges bestowed on the Gentile of the Week is the opportunity to ask an internationally recognized panel of Jewish experts anything you want about Judaism. Now, look, you had 4 years at Yale and 3 years of Harvard Law to ask a lot of Jews a lot of questions. So I don't imagine there's that much that's gone unanswered. But is there anything still just sticking in your craw, anything you don't understand about us, our people, our faith, our habits?
Okay, so I have two questions. So is that okay?
Yes, okay.
Very Jewish.
Yes, Congresswoman.
So it is very Jewish, isn't it? It's very Jewish. So my first question is about this upcoming holiday, which is, I think, you know, kind of not a huge one, but Tu B'Shvat, right? And so why are you having like your Arbor Day in the dead of winter? So, I mean, what are you supposed to do? Like, why not have your Arbor Day, say, in the spring or the fall, like,
normal people?
Yeah.
Can I throw this to RJ?
Yeah.
Is there...
So it's two parts. It's why give us a what is Tu B'Shvat, and then also how you make it relevant when it's in the middle of winter to your students or campers.
Who feels like you own Tu B'Shvat with your kids? Like, who is the queen or king?
We won't talk about spelling it because we'll never agree.
Okay, we'll get two answers.
Right up here in the front, Josh.
Yeah.
Although it is colder in Israel right now than in the springtime, the first trees in Israel are just barely getting their buds, and the tree that does it first is the almond tree, the Shkedia, and it's happening really soon.
All right.
So really soon.
So there you go. It's
so what do we do? What should we be doing for Tu B'Shvat in the winter?
We should be acknowledging that we have an earth that gives us trees every year, or that gives us buds and flowers and fruit and lots of good things, and that we're lucky that each year we have this, and we should be saying thank you for all of it.
There we go. So
it's when the
almond tree starts budding.
Interestingly, according to the Mishnah, we have four New Years during the year. There's the first of Nisan, which is New Year's for kings and rulers. The first of Elul, which is the new year for beasts. The first of Tishrei, which is a new year for all of recorded history and time. And the 15th of Shvat, which is new year for trees.
So you get your money's worth.
Yeah.
You should, by the way, legislate that calendar to make it, you know, for everyone.
Yeah, totally.
It's a bank holiday.
Yeah.
So my other question is, I've had the chance to participate in and attend lots of Jewish services as a candidate, which I've really, really enjoyed. But Orange County, as you may know, is also the home of several very large evangelical Christian churches, including Mariners Church and Saddleback Church and the Crystal Cathedral back in the day and some of those. And so
production... The late lamented Crystal Cathedral.
It really is like a faux Crystal Cathedral. And so production value is really important at these churches. So my question is, could the bima like burst open so that the rabbi could spring kind of onto the stage?
With like his microphone.
So you've touched on a sensitive subject.
Well, so I asked, like, is there a green room where I can like burst through there? And like, I won't touch the scrolls or anything, but I just think it would be so cool.
I mean, there are some very cool robes back there that we almost put on to wear out, but... That felt sacrilegious.
Josh, you have an answer to that?
Well, my kids just watched Raiders of the Lost Ark last night, and you got to be careful with what you open.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, Mark, take this one.
Yeah, the production value, let's put it this way. No one approaches the evangelical Christians in terms of production values. I mean, they're an hour start to finish. They've got a rock band on stage. They've got really good PowerPoint.
They have, like, great merch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great merch. And they have the food courts. I mean, you've been to these mega churches where you've got your McDonald's, you've got your Chick-fil-A, then you've got your other Chick-fil-A, and then...
That's the Chick-fil-A you don't go to.
Your other Chick-fil-A. And, you know, the reality is we are a simple peasant people. And, you know, we've got some books on scroll, and, you know, in another couple thousand years, we'll hope to approach that. But it's a fair question.
I hope we don't.
What's that?
I hope we don't.
I hope we don't, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, this is as close to, like, mega church as I want to get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Representative Porter, if these fine... You're going to hang out for a little while afterwards, mm-hmm. I understand, and schmooze. But if these fine people or out there in podcast land want to, like... I bet you have a Michael Twitter account, as we're calling them now. How can they follow you?
Yep, so our official account is... it's pretty clever. They're given... They give you your name. So it's at Rep Katie Porter, and not at Rep Katie Hill.
Wait.
At Rep Katie Porter.
Someone could squat on that, though. How do they make sure nobody...
No, I don't know.
How do they make sure Mimi Walter didn't squat on at Rep Katie Porter?
I don't know. But I am thinking of buying some URLs in anticipation of 2020, right? So one of the free tips I'll give you...
RealKatiePorter.org. Yeah.
Yes. If any of you are thinking of running for office someday... where you think your child shows political promise, you should run out and buy not only their URL, like markoppenheimer.com, but you should also buy, like, markoppenheimerisacrook.com, markoppenheimerisnottrustworthy.com. Like, you should buy all of the related sites.
To show how proud you are of your child.
Yeah,
how
you should just lock them down. Yeah. Lock them down. So, and then my other site is, it's at Katie Porter OC. And so today we just posted some videos talking about something I've been working on, which is with regard to furloughed workers. I got to make my first speech on the House floor, which was very fun. And it's a little bit like being the Gentile of the week. Like, you're not quite sure what this means. It seems like a little bit of a risk, but like one worth taking. And one of the things that we did is I called on the nation's largest banks, credit card issuers, and mortgage companies to not charge any late fees, any interest, and do any negative credit reporting on unpaid workers. And so I've been starting to have meetings with those bankers and trying to help. Because we talk about we're going to make these workers whole by paying them back pay. That really misses the fact that there's an interim hardship that you can never put back the insecurity and the anxiety and the fear that those families are feeling right now trying to make ends meet. And so trying to make sure that they're not digging themselves deeper in terms of late fees and credit card fees. So that's been my first project.
Amen.
Rock on.
Representative Porter, thank you so much for making your debut as Gentile of the Week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Congresswoman.
We have one more chance for audience participation, which is it's time for the Mazel Tovs. As you know, we close every show with the Mazel Tovs. We're going to do a few, and then we want to open it up for 5 or 10 of you to give quick Mazel Tovs that, you know, some of them may make it on the air. I'm just going to say that I have a few Mazel Tovs this week. I want to give a refuah shalema, a get well, to Lydia Belser. I want to give a big Mazel Tov on the air to Dr. Sasha Goldstein-Sabach for getting his PhD about the Jewish congregations of Iraq finally approved after a long journey of research around the world. And Dina Kronfeld asked me if I would wish a very special Mazel Tov to her husband, Tristan Shelton, on the one-year anniversary of his conversion. Mazel Tov, Tristan Shelton.
I like that. That's a good name, Tristan. We need more Tristans. My Mazel Tov is to my very best friend, Kat, who's here. She just got a new dog, and her name is Olive, and I met her, and she is so cute.
I've seen the pictures.
Yeah.
Very cute dog.
They're on Instagram.
Liel,
so just Mazel Tov.
Mazel Tov. Do you have any Mazel Tovs, Liel?
Yeah, you know, so I live vicariously through Stephanie's family. We all do. So my Mazel Tov is to show favorite Grandpa Al and Cecile Rothaus, Stephanie's grandparents, who are celebrating their 65th anniversary this week.
We're going to Florida.
We love you, Grandpa Allen, Grandma Cecile.
Amazing.
You can come to Florida for the party.
Nice. All right. Let's do these two lines. If you're in line right now, we want to hear your Mazel Tov. Let's start with you, Josh.
All right. First, I'm giving one to our listener, Matt Sheeran, because he knows exactly what he did.
He helped Josh with an Excel document.
It's more than that.
I'm Melissa Stein. And I want to give a gigantic Mazel Tov to the Sperling Milner family. Yeah. Their daughter read her entire Parsha in Braille for Shabbat this week for her bat mitzvah.
Amazing.
Cool.
That sounds like something we might want to talk about on an episode of Unorthodox. All right, we got to do these really fast. We want to get to as many people as possible.
My name is Miles Roger, and I would like to wish Mazel Tov to my brother, Eddie, who is celebrating his 36th double high birthday.
Mazel Tov.
Ooh. I'm Patty Lieberman. I wanted to give a Mazel Tov to my niece, Yael, and her husband, Sammy, on having the first girl in our family in 30 years after 13 straight boys.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Let's do it.
I'm Sophia Nade, and I want to give a Mazel Tov to my mom, Laura Nade, who organized this taping.
Yay!
I've seen how hard she worked to make this a success, and I think we can all agree that she did an incredible job. So
amazing.
Mazel Tov, Mom.
Yay!
Sir.
I'm Yitz Sandberg. Just want to give a shout-out to my fellow federal employees. Just, we can do this. We can get through it.
You can do it, guys.
Give that guy some swag.
I'm Ben Duak. I want to give a Mazel Tov to my sister Amanda on giving birth to a baby girl.
Yay!
Yay!
Baby girls all over.
My name is Ricky Grosskopf, and I would like to extend a Mazel Tov to my friend Carissa, who just got married after being engaged to her now husband Jacob for 2 years.
Mazel Tov. Mazel Tov.
Hi, I'm Michael Ramsey, and I want to give a Mazel Tov to my partner Brian Schwartz, who moved in with me last Friday. We now live next door to the synagogue, so.
Oh, it's perfect.
Mazel Tov to Brian for making a good life choice.
So no excuses.
My name is Sam Nellis. I want to give a Mazel Tov to Luke and Mary Feinberg, who welcomed their second child yesterday, healthy and happy Jackson.
Mazel Tov.
Hey. My name is Tali Kuehl. I want to wish a huge Mazel Tov to my friend Avi Rothfeld and to his fiancée, Stephanie Abrahamoff. He's a huge fan of the podcast, so this is going to mean a lot to him.
Yay. Invite us to your wedding.
I'm Brad Stillman, and I want to wish a Mazel Tov to all of the Charles E. Smith Jewish Day School seniors who will graduate in this very sanctuary in just a couple of weeks, including my son, Gabe.
Mazel Tov, Charles E. Smith Day School graduates.
Hi, my name is Brett Bourne, and I just wanted to give a Mazel Tov to Eliana Ross Layton. She is not, in fact, Jewish, but she does have Jewish ancestry, and her best friend is a Holocaust survivor who's a very close friend of my mom's.
Mazel Tov, Eliana.
There we have it.
Congresswoman Eliana Ross Layton.
My name is Lowell Brazen. I want to give a Mazel Tov to my brother-in-law and sister who called me at 7:28 this evening to tell me they're pregnant with their second child.
Aww. You were like, excuse me, I'm at a taping of a podcast. Can I call you back?
Hi, my name's Tatiana Becker, and I want to wish Mazel Tov to my boyfriend, Joshua Greenberg, who just finished his third semester at Hebrew College. He's in rabbinical school, and he's a huge fan of the podcast, so I hope this makes it on, because I love him, and that would really make him happy.
Mazel Tov, rabbinic student Josh, who attends the seminary whose president performed my wedding, Sharon Annisfeld. So, Mazel Tov.
I'm Laura Nade, again. And I'd like to wish refuah shlema to one of our ARJE members, Vanessa Ehrlich, who so dearly wanted to be here, but was not able to travel because of some health issues. I would also like to wish a mazel tov to Mandy Herlich, who is the best friend, co-planner, wonderful person anyone could ever hope to meet. I love you, Mandy.
Mazel tov. All right, we got three more.
Hi, I'm Lisa Alperin, and I just wanted to wish a mazel tov to Mandy and Laura both, who have done an amazing job at the, I think I'm going to call it Arj, right?
Arj.
So, mazel tov.
Mazel tov.
My name is Missy Bell, and I want to wish a mazel tov to Dr. Kathy Schwartz, who will be installed tomorrow morning as the new president of the Arj.
Dr. Schwartz.
Wow.
Hi, my name is Lauren Glazer, and I think we should all mazel tov Rachel Banks on her recent work promotion.
Clearly we should. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. You can ask for our newsletter by writing to unorthodox at tabletmag.com and putting newsletter in the subject line. We often come to you live, like tonight at Washington Hebrew Congregation with RJ. To book us or advertise with us, email producer Josh Cross, that's Cross with a K, jcross@tabletmag.com. And of course, you need to wear and carry Unorthodox as well. You can do that by coming to a live show and winning it, or you can go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt and find the latest in Unorthodox shirts, mugs, and onesies. No baby is too young to be a billboard for our podcast. Follow us on Instagram at Unorthodox Podcast, on Twitter at Unorthodox_pod. You can join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Josh Cross, Shira Tilishkin, and Noah Levinson. Our editor is Sophia Steinert Evoy. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our social media intern is Elazar Abrams. Our other intern is Jillian Forstadt for at least a couple more weeks. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision by three fine rabbis this week, Rabbi Rebecca Reese and Rabbis Rachel Gartner and Benjamin Bearer. Shalom, friends.